Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Barbara Liskov, MIT Institute Professor, 2008 ACM Turing Award recipient, 2004 IEEE John von Neumann Medal recipient, Fellow of the ACM and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, distinguished, celebrated, eminent, world-renowned researcher. Barbara, you have a lifetime of outstanding contributions in a number of fields. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you very much for the interview.
So when did you hear of this extraordinary honor, this recipient of this sort of Nobel Prize of Computing, the 2008 ACM Turing Award? How did you feel at the time, and what was the reaction from your colleagues and from your family?
I heard about it in a phone call that I received from a person I've known for a long, long time, though I haven't seen him recently. And when I picked up the phone, I thought he was just calling for something or other. I said, "Nice to hear from you again." And then he told me about it, and I was very surprised. He said, "I hope you're sitting down," and I did, in fact, sit down right away. However, this was about a month before the public announcement, and I was told that I couldn't tell anybody. So for a month, I told my husband, and I was able, informed I could tell one of my close colleagues, but other than that, nobody knew. So I went around for a month knowing this was coming without being able to talk about it. When finally the public announcement happened, the reaction of my colleagues was, you know, wonderfully positive, and it's really been, you know, wonderful to get that reaction from both my colleagues at MIT and also my professional colleagues around the world.
Well, a truly exciting time, and of course, very much deserved. You're such an extraordinary figure, and over such a long lifetime of career accomplishments and so on and contribution. Because of that, can you tell us more about your vision and objectives behind your current roles, and what do you hope to accomplish, and how you will bring this about?
So at present, I actually am still a professor at MIT, and I am working first as a with a bunch of graduate students. We're still doing research, but in addition, I have a position as Associate Provost for Faculty Equity, and so I'm working within MIT to increase opportunities on the faculty for women and underrepresented minorities. And in the first case, what I'm trying to do is to advance research within computer science, especially in the area of distributed computing. In the latter case, I'm trying to improve the situation for women and underrepresented minorities.
Barbara, you have this very unique role in a sense because of your, as I mentioned, outstanding contributions, and you have so many honors for your lifetime body of work. Do you find that they contribute to your vision and to your work with industry and governments and academia, technology and so on? Do they help in your work?
It's very nice to get this recognition, and I believe that it does make my work more visible than it was before it happened. And to that extent, yes, it probably does at least contribute to perhaps more of a dialogue between people in industry and people in academia, in my work in particular. I'm not sure that it contributes to my vision, because my vision is the advancing state of computer science and all the exciting things that are happening, particularly in the research community, developing the fundamental techniques that enable the systems of tomorrow.
So why were you initially attracted to computing?
Well, sort of accidentally. I graduated with a degree in mathematics at a time when computer science was very young, and in fact, I didn't even know there was such a thing. And I went with a bachelor's degree. I decided that I was tired of going to school, so I went to look for a job. And I couldn't get an interesting job as a mathematician. All I could find was a job where they seemed to want me to plot graphs. But I found an interesting job as a programmer. At that time, you know, nobody was graduating with a degree in computer science, and companies that needed programmers were happy to take anybody that came in with a background that indicated they might be able to do it. And so I got a job as a programmer, and I discovered that I had a real bent for computing. And so that's, in fact, what happened.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you were the first U.S. woman to receive a Ph.D. from a computing science department. What were the major challenges you faced at the time, and how did you overcome them? And which challenges still exist today, and can you outline others that are new?
I think that I was very naive when I started my Ph.D. work. I never really stopped to think about the fact that I was just, you know, a woman among in a male-dominated field. At Stanford, I was the only woman in the class that was admitted the year I started. One woman came in the following year. But I never really thought about the fact that we were a minority. I'm not sure that I had challenges in doing the work at Stanford, because my feeling there was that, you know, the students were accepting and we did stuff together and everything was moving along. I probably did experience challenges when it came to getting a job, because at that point, academic positions really weren't open to women. There were very few women faculty in math and science, and I certainly didn't get any particular help from the from Stanford. It just wasn't the thing that, you know, women were doing. So the way I overcame that challenge was I went back to work in industry, which probably was a good thing because I was also changing fields, and eventually, you know, got enough of a reputation in the field I changed to be able to go back to academia. At that point, however, also things had changed, and that was the time of Title IX, and there was a push on to try and increase the representation of women in science and technology. And so MIT was actively looking for women, which certainly helped. As far as today is concerned, I think, you know, the situation is really quite a bit better. I would say that the kind of overt discrimination that used to happen is probably not happening anymore, but I don't think that the problems are gone. I think there's a lot of unconscious discrimination. So one of the things I do in my job as associate provost is to try and educate people about all the unconscious bias that still exists.
So that's really quite interesting in terms of, you know, your sort of path that you followed and the kind of work that you're doing now to improve the situation with underrepresented groups. But you also talked about the fact that you did some work in industry. So what were the most important lessons that you want to share from your time at MITRE Corp?
So as I said, you know, when I got my PhD, I didn't see a path for me in as a faculty member I was looking for sort of a major institution. And so I went to work for MITRE, which was the same place where I had worked originally when I finished my bachelor's degree. And and when I went to MITRE, I also switched fields. So I did my PhD work in artificial intelligence, more or less accidentally, just because I happened to meet John McCarthy, who is a very eminent computer scientist, early when I arrived at Stanford and started to work with him. But I realized during the course of my graduate career that artificial intelligence really wasn't the area I wanted to be, and I wanted to switch to computer systems. And I decided to complete my thesis in artificial intelligence, and that seemed like the easiest way to get finished. But when I went to MITRE, I switched areas. And so I had to learn, you know, a new area, start to do work in a different area. And it was, I think, very beneficial for me that I went to work at MITRE, because if I had tried to be a faculty member and also switch fields at the same time, I don't think that would have worked. I guess that, you know, the lesson I learned at MITRE is a kind of an odd one. When I started work at MITRE, I was still thinking about work rather than a career. I had this idea that It was very nice to work. That would fill in time, but probably when I had a family, I would stop. And I came to realize while I was at MITRE that I was really dedicated to a career, and so I began to think of my life in very different terms. You know, the way I thought of it when I started at MITRE was very much colored by being a woman in my generation where women weren't expected to have careers. And so I had to, all by myself, sort of get over that mindset and think about things in a different way.
So, you know, you did some really interesting research and work at MITRE that kind of laid the foundation for some of your later achievements. So how would you describe your top innovative achievements in terms of the problems you're trying to solve, the solutions you came up with, and then the impact it has today and into the future?
So the work I did at MITRE got me very interested in how to organize programs, how to divide programs into modules in an effective way or more effective way than what was done at the time. At the time, people thought about modules in terms of subroutines, in other words, functions you could call with some arguments, they'd return a result, and you didn't have to think about how they actually acted, you only had to think about what they did. And what I came to realize at MITRE was that this was not a very effective unit for modularizing. The problem in computer science is that unlike, for example, in electrical engineering where you build things out of components that are discrete components that are connected together by wires, for example, in computer science there's no natural way of organizing things. And so the major challenge in the early days of computer science was sort of trying to come to grips with how did you organize in a world where everything was fluid. And so I came up with this idea of what I originally called a multi-operation module, but which ultimately turned into the notion of abstract data types or data abstraction, where this separation between the idea of having a black box with a behavior that was made available to the outside and where the implementation was hidden and could be changed without affecting the outside, happened in bigger chunks around data rather than just in terms of procedures or subroutines. So I think my first major achievement was, and really the most important achievement, was the whole notion of abstract data types. I then went forward with that. I decided to put it into a programming language because I felt that the ideas were sort of nebulous when just described in the abstract, but by putting the whole idea into a programming language, I would make it very precise. And also, since people write programs in programming languages, that would be a very good way of communicating to the whole technical community what was going on. So that led to the development of this language called CLUE, C-L-U. CLUE stood for the first three letters of cluster. Cluster was the major linguistic mechanism that was used to define abstract data types. I also did a lot of work at that time on how to specify abstract data types, because a major component of this was the separation of what from how, and specifications would describe what an abstract data type was supposed to do, and then in the programming language you would implement that behavior. And of course the major idea was then you could re-implement it and the users would only depend on the specification, would not be affected by the fact that you changed the implementation. Now after I finished working on CLUE in around about 1980, I was looking for the next thing to do. And at that point, the internet existed. It was the ARPANET in those days. And people understood how to send email. And they were sort of interested in how to write programs that ran on multiple computers, but they really didn't understand how to do that. And so then I started to work in distributed computing, and I developed a second language called Argus, which was based on my work in CLUE and provided a way of writing programs that ran on multiple computers over the internet. Also at that time, I happened to give a keynote talk at Uppsala, which is the major sort of programming language, object-oriented programming language conference. And in preparing for that talk, I started to read lots of papers about what was then called object-oriented programming. And I discovered that they hadn't got the idea of modularity right. They were always thinking in terms of the implementation. So they would talk about how a subclass was related to the class because you changed the implementation in this way. And so I gave a keynote at Uppsala in, I think, 1987, in which I described what has come to be known as the Liskov substitution principle. This is not a name that I invented, but was invented by others. And the idea there was simply that you should be thinking in terms of their specifications, not in terms of their implementations. And in particular, the principle says that when you define a subclass, the behavior of the object of the subclass, when used through an interface of the superclass, should be indistinguishable from the superclass, so that programs that were written in terms of the superclass did not become broken because you were using an object of the subclass. So I would say that's the third thing. So what I've explained is abstract data types, CLUE and specifications, then Argus, the language that I developed for distributed computing, then the Liskov substitution principle. Later on, I worked with Jeanette Wing, and we developed a way of formalizing that principle. Then I started to work in distributed computing. I got very interested, for fault tolerance with a very strong correctness condition. And then subsequently in the 90s, when I was working, first of all, on a system called Thor that provided an object-oriented database provided over the Internet, I then went on to work on Byzantine fault tolerance, so replication techniques that continue to work correctly even when some of the nodes that make up the group of replicas behave in a Byzantine manner. In other words, they behave arbitrarily badly and might pretend to be acting correctly when they're actually not. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is that I did some work in information flow control, which is a way of preserving confidentiality of online information. I did that with one of my students, Andrew Myers, in the 1990s, and that's one of the major things that I'm working on today.
I see. So can you then continue to profile your current research, the particular challenges and opportunities and its implications?
So I'm very interested today in storage on the Internet or storage in the cloud. And what I believe is going to be happening in the future, it's already starting now, is that the responsibility for storing data is going to be removed from your personal machines and put onto storage services that are available over the Internet. So already you can see Amazon is offering such a service, Google is offering such a service, and I think that this is going to become sort of the universal way of doing business. For example, as a user of my personal machine, I would really very much like to offload this job because, first of all, I don't want my data tied to my machine. I'd like to be able to access my data from many different places, my cell phone, something in an internet cafe, as well as my personal computer at home or my machine at work. But in addition, I'd like to not have to worry about all the things I have to worry about today. For example, I need to make sure I back up things properly, otherwise I might lose something. If my machine fails entirely, what do I do about that? And so forth. So there's many reasons why I would really like to get the data off my machine into a storage service on the Internet. And my major research focus today is what are the properties that storage service has to provide in order for me to really be happy with it. And I've been interested, first of all, in how we ensure that the data I put into this storage service is always there when I need it, never gets lost, and that's where my work on replication comes in. But then I'm additionally very interested in the confidentiality of my information, and that's my major focus right now.
I see. So where do you, or I guess when do you see the sort of the tangible outcomes of this research being seen perhaps in industrial products?
Well, the way it works is that things are developed in research labs and then they migrate into industrial products as the need becomes apparent. So the work I did in the late 80s, early 90s on developing replication techniques that handle benign failures, in other words, failures where machines crash but they don't misbehave, that has showed up in industry in the 2000s, around 2002 or something in that time frame. So what you see there is a lag of about 10 years. And so I expect, you know, similar kinds of lags where the work that is done in academia sort of develops the techniques that, you know, will be needed when the time comes. So I think that the work on Byzantine fault tolerance will eventually show up in certain products, and the work that I'm doing now, I think, will eventually show up in certain products.
You know, it's interesting. You laid many of the pillars that we sort of take for granted as IT practitioners. So really an amazing contribution over a long period of time.
Well, thank you.
So over your long and distinguished career, what are your top lessons that you want to share with the broad audience?
You don't make contributions without focus. So you have to work at things. You know, creativity comes from somewhere, and I don't think it can be programmed. But unless you're really focused on problems and thinking about them, you won't have the creative ideas that allow you to make progress. So my first lesson is you have to really work at the problem. On the other hand, it's also very important to not work all the time. What I have found over the course of my career is that my most creative ideas actually happen after some downtime. So I'll be thinking about something during the day. I would go home at night. I'm not a person who worked at home at night. You know, things would just be sort of turning around, and then often driving into work the next morning, as I would sort of start to review what do I want to do today, I would discover that I had an idea about how to solve a problem that had been on my mind the day before. So you need to focus, but you also need that downtime. And then aside from that, I think you need a life. So one of the things I see with some of the young people is that they feel that they have to work all the time and they can't afford to stop and, you know, find a partner or, you know, have their hobbies and so forth. So I think it's very important to have a balanced life. And then the other thing is that it's very important to have a sense of humor. You know, when I think back over lots of committee meetings that I've been in, and I've no doubt experienced the kinds of things that women complain about where they say something and then, you know, somebody sort of overrides their idea and then somebody else picks up the same thing and, you know, and the man gets credit for it. I've found that when people do sort of silly things like that, if I laugh about it, it sort of diffuses the whole situation and turns what could have been a negative thing into a positive thing. So a sense of humor is very important. And I guess the last thing is that when I run meetings, which I often do, I try very hard to make sure that people do get credit for what they suggest. So I'm often reiterating. I say, well, X said, you know, this idea, this is an interesting idea, what do people say about it? So I want to make sure people get credit for things, and I also want to make sure that ideas don't get lost in the general discussion. So there you are.
Those are amazing tips and really reflect, you know, as again, this lifelong sort of, you know, career that you've had, that's just an amazing sort of life of contribution and impact, or what I would call contribution, impact, purpose, and significance. Now, if you can sum up your life experiences with career tips for people entering the computing field, what would be your tips and the reasons behind them?
Well, so some of them are the things I said before. Of course, I was focused mainly on people who are, you know, sort of, you know, doing research and so forth. I think that, you know, one thing is to actually be a professional. So, you know, join your professional organizations. Keep up with the literature. Really pay attention to what's going on around you. Because that way you will, you know, have the tools that you need to do your job. You'll be able to know that in the problem you're trying to solve now, there's been some new work that provides you with a better way of doing things than would have been possible before. So I think that's probably, aside from the stuff I already said, much of which, you know, carries over into many different environments, I would say that's an additional thing that a professional ought to keep in mind.
I guess there's this other aspect that I see in your career, and you can tell me if I'm right or not, and that is you're willing to think out of the sandbox. You're not afraid to take on challenges or venturing into foreign territory. You don't see that as barriers. You see those as opportunities. Do you take that kind of viewpoint?
Yeah, I think I do. I think I've always been sort of interested in moving beyond what's happening, and that you can see that in the course of my career.
You're at an amazing juncture in terms of history and contribution, as I indicated, due to your research and the impact you've had over many, many years. And so because of that, because of your sort of kind of this hub of this ecosystem, can you make your predictions for the future, their implications, and how people can take advantage of these or best prepare for these?
So the challenges of the future. All right, so I think that when it comes to getting an education, the best thing you can do is to get a broad education. This doesn't mean, if you're interested in computer science, you need to get the depth in computer science so you really understand the field. But it's also important, and I'm talking now about undergraduate education, not to focus too much on any one particular subfield, because you don't know where you're going in the future, and you need to have a grounding that will make it possible for you to move your area. One thing you see in my career is I have moved my area. I started off in artificial intelligence, then I moved into computer systems, then I moved into programming languages, then I moved into distributed computing. And this is not an uncommon thing to see. You'll see this in many other people's careers. So you need to have the grounding that allows you to make those shifts as time goes by, because what's going to be happening in the future is not the same as what's happening today, and the problems that are interesting will be different then. So I think that's one major thing. I mean, the main thing is you don't know what's going to happen in the future, and so the most you can do is to sort of be ready so that you can move when the time comes.
You know, we talked about some of the areas of research, and now you're looking into storage and in storage in the cloud and how to manage that from a security standpoint and replicating and so on. I guess the other question sort of related to that is, are there other kinds of technologies out there that you see coming up that you think we need to pay attention to now? For example, maybe semantic computing perhaps, or some other kinds of innovations that are coming on the horizon?
Well, I can see some problems coming on. You know, one of the things that's happening today is that people are starting to design machines that have many cores. So, a core is like an individual processing unit, and they're talking about machines. Today, the machine on your desk maybe has two cores or four cores, and they're starting to talk about machines with hundreds of cores, thousands of cores, and people really don't understand how to program these machines. So the issue of how to write parallel programs has been a long-standing one that people have never had a satisfactory solution for. And I think maybe, you know, now that problem is going to come to the fore again, and it's really unclear, you know, how we're going to be able to give people the intellectual tools that will allow them to cope with that kind of an environment. Distributed computing is also like that, but in distributed computing you tend to do concurrency in large chunks, and one of the problems with these multi-core machines is maybe those chunks have to be smaller, and it's really unclear how to do that. So I see that as a major technical problem sort of looming in the future.
Do you have any views on things like quantum computing?
Well, quantum computing has yet to prove itself. You know, there are quantum computers that can do a little bit of stuff. So I'm not sure I see that as, if they manage to come up with a quantum computer that does more than, what they're able to do today, you know, then maybe that will be interesting. Certainly there are research projects in quantum computing and biological computing, and it'll be interesting to see what comes of those. I personally think that computational biology is an extremely interesting area right now. And also I think that computation is everywhere. And so one of the things I've seen over my career is a real change in the way that computer scientists are viewed by scientists. Once upon a time, and this is not that long ago, people in the sciences thought of computer people as just being programmers, and really they thought they could do everything themselves. Now I believe they've really come to realize that to get the right kind of performance and system requires a deep expertise in computer science. And what you see in computer science more and more is a lot of interdisciplinary work where computer scientists work closely with specialists in other areas, you know, in biology and physics and chemistry, to help build the systems that are of interest in those areas.
I see. So that sort of ties into this idea of computational concept, or some people call computational education, that sort of tie in with multidisciplinary studies.
Yes, I think that's actually very important. I mean, computation is in the humanities these days, and so really everybody ought to have at least an idea of what computation is about.
Do you ever think that the promise of the semantic web will ever be realized? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about it. You're starting to see some companies come out with products associated with, you know, a fruition, I guess, of this sort of idea of a meaningful web. Do you think it's really going to be realized?
My guess is that machine learning is going to take over. So machine learning is a technique that allows programs to learn about stuff. And the problem that they're trying to address with the semantic web is a really difficult one, because the trouble is that different people express the same concept in different ways, and how do you make sense out of that? And they're trying to do it by, you know, sort of defining a framework in which to place this stuff. But maybe a better way is not to do that, but instead to have the tools that will allow programs to figure out what the similarities are. And I suspect that might be a better way to go. But, you know, time will tell.
I guess there's also this whole aspect of the Turing test and artificial intelligence, which was originally your PhD.
Right.
And do you ultimately see this sort of becoming a reality where, you know, a computer will be indistinguishable when you're communicating with one?
Well, that's an interesting question. In some ways, computers are already indistinguishable. It depends upon what you're testing them on. So if you test, say, a computer chess player versus a person, you know, mostly you can't tell the difference. On the other hand, if you are talking about qualities like empathy, or, you know, picking up on the cues of behavior, computers can't do that yet. So it's a moving target. But, you know, computers can do things today that they certainly, you know, certainly couldn't do when I started in my career. And it's really quite amazing what they're able to do. And this whole idea of machine learning, you know, is something that's come along recently. It's a long-standing subfield of AI, but in the last, say, 15 years, amazing progress has been made.
I guess, and then, you know, we also have petaflop computers, and who knows where that's going to lead as well, right?
Yes, well, that's what I was talking about when I was talking about those multi-cores, because that's how you get that kind of processing power.
You know, Barbara, you laid many of the pillars for modern-day computing as one of the top groundbreaking visionary innovators. How do you wish to continue to shape the world and contribute to the fabric of history?
Well, I will just continue to do my thing. In other words, the research projects that I'm interested in. And of course, the other thing I should mention is that a major way in which an educator shapes history is through their students. So over the course of my career, I've educated many students. I have, you know, a large number of PhDs who have gone out where I taught them all how to do modular program construction. And that latter group, I think, has been a major influence on what happens out in the technology companies, because those people are working in different companies. They bring that grounding. They often send me emails, even today, talking about how they found that particular course shaped the way they think about things, and they found it so useful. So one way in which I can, probably the major way in which I can affect history is through my students.
Well, you've done an amazing job, and I guess you get this sort of idea of, you know, two or three degrees or 1 degree of separation, and, you know, you are such a role model, and that'll have an impact for many generations to come. So, again, as an IT practitioner, I thank you for all of this foundational research that you've done.
Well, you're very welcome.
So what do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Well, you know, the top challenges are the ones that everybody points out. So we have global warming. We have energy consumption and finding alternate forms of energy. We have health care and finding ways to deliver quality health care at less expense. So none of these looks on the surface like a computer science problem, but in fact all of them are computer science problems, because part of the solution is going to be through the automatic control that computers can offer. So I think that, you know, looking to the future, computer science has a rich future, both in the sort of core technology, which is the kind of stuff I do, but also in this interdisciplinary work where computers are part of the solution to very important problems.
You know, that's interesting. I guess it's good to get that information out as well to a broad public audience. And the reason is, you know, since 2002, there's been, up to a 60 to 70% decline in enrollments. But I understand this year, for the first time, there's been a 6.2% increase in enrollments. So the first time in 6 years, and it's just getting this information out of how valuable, you know, and the contributions that computer science makes to every field.
Yes, I think that we are seeing increasing enrollments, and I think that, you know, when I spoke about breadth and how you need to be prepared for going in many different paths in the future, people do tend to react too much to the short term. So the technology bubble burst, and students and probably their parents all thought, oh, that's a bad area to go in. But, you know, it's not, because it opens up doors to many other areas as well as the core technology that the students learn about. With a background in computer science, you can go into law, you can go into medicine, you can go into bioengineering. And, you know, the list is just endless, and that kind of thinking and the knowledge that you have about how computation works is valuable in many fields.
You know, we already touched upon this very early in the interview, and that is this sort of underrepresentation in computing, and I know you're now involved in this area. So what groups are underrepresented, and how can this be addressed?
Well, women are definitely underrepresented compared to their proportion in the society at large. 50% of the world are women, and I'm not sure of exactly the numbers, but somewhere between 20 and 25% of professional computer programmers, you know, professional computer people are women. So there's definitely a problem there. And then, of course, when you look at underrepresented minorities like African Americans, Hispanics, and so forth, they are even more underrepresented. Their proportions in the profession are very small. I'm not sure exactly how that plays out versus their proportion in the population at large, but both of those groups are underrepresented. I think that the problems are probably different in the two cases. In the case of women, I think it has a lot to do with what's going on before they get to university. They get turned off to computer science. Maybe the courses they're offered in high school aren't the greatest. I know there's work going on to revamp that curriculum in the hopes of making it more interesting. I think this may turn around a little bit because of what's going on today on the Internet with all the social networking, which makes what computers can do perhaps seem friendlier to women than when all they were doing was having games that you could kill people with. So maybe we'll see a certain improvement in the representation of women in the field in the future. The problems in the case of underrepresented minorities, you know, those are immense problems having to do with lack of access to quality education in the early years and stuff like that. I think the main point is that these are really not problems that can be solved at the university. They are societal problems that we have to work on, especially in the education that's available to people before they reach the university.
So you're really speaking then K-12, and it's like the ALICE program from, I guess, Carnegie Mellon, and those kinds of ideas as well.
Yeah, I don't know the ALICE program, but yes, I think it is K-12. And, you know, and also probably support for kids even younger than that, preschool programs and in the case of underrepresented minorities.
Well, we're coming to the end of the interview, so I usually end with a sort of concluding question. If you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I feel like we actually have covered a lot of territory, so I think that I don't really have anything to add.
Well, Barbara, you know, we really appreciate you coming in today, and I know your schedule is very demanding, so we are indeed fortunate to have you do this interview. So thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom and experience and talent with our audience.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed the interview.
I am Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Barbara Liskov, MIT Institute Professor, 2008 ACM Turing Award recipient, 2004 IEEE John von Neumann Medal recipient, Fellow of the ACM and American Academy of Arts and Sciences, distinguished, celebrated, world-renowned researcher.